hell knows what's going on here. It's a bunch of programmers with a bunch of gear, and God knows if we end up with something useful out of this whole thing. So I'm Daniel Markham. This is Nerd Roundup, and today is June 3rd. You should be watching this on June 4th. And if you haven't been to a Nerd Roundup before, the basic idea here is that we take the week's news, as far as us nerds are concerned, and talk about it from a technical standpoint. We're not afraid of topics. We like to model the behavior we want to see in teams, and to have a good team, you got to be able to kick back and joke and talk about stuff. So that's what we want to do. If by any chance you learn anything during this next half hour or so, I'm very sorry. I did not mean for that to happen. We try to make this very technical and also content free at the same time, which is kind of difficult to balance, but we do it most days. So guys, has anybody actually read any of these articles?
I looked at the first three words of each one.
I'm going to stop reading my own articles. That way I could be at the same as everybody else.
I have not.
No. I just realized I had time, and I was like, oh, I can join this finally. Awesome.
So driving and reading is not supposed to be something you're supposed to do. So.
No, that is a bad thing. Although I have a son-in-law that watches Netflix while he drives, and it's... I don't want to know. So this first link is a PDF about the scandal hypothesis, and the idea is that tumors can evolve into parasites, which can then evolve into creatures of their own. So it's like this thing that begins with cancer ends up with new creatures, which, if true, would be really crazy. It's a wild concept.
Alien.
It is, yeah. If a lot of life is ended up, you know, we think of cancer as being sort of end-of-life stuff. And if this is actually sort of the beginning of the circle of life, you know, I don't know, it's an odd thing. I don't want to be some bump on somebody's nose somewhere. It makes me sad.
Especially because I take it as it's kind of dissing Bugs Bunny. It's talking about the Tasmanian devil facial tumor disease.
Yeah, you know, Tasmanian, they're dying out.
So this, what is the essence of this one, Daniel? How does a tumor evolve into a separate creature?
Well, they keep finding these like huge strings of DNA in these creatures that don't make any sense that they should be there. And so, like, we have viruses inside our cells, and some viruses, there's like these huge viruses that are found with a bunch of other stuff inside. And they're trying to figure out, how could it be so mixed up? At first, they were like, you know, we could maybe end up with some virus inside our cell if we had a lot of viruses over the last, you know, 400,000 years or whatever, but it's just too much. And so some scientists are going, you know, actually, guys, this is actually its own little evolutionary kind of deal going on.
So is this a statistical argument? Are they saying, look, there's just too much of this strange viral DNA in our genome, and therefore there must have been some separate path of evolution from tumors to dogs?
Well, yeah, this is a genomic analysis. So all of biology now is pretty much statistical, what they call it, computational biology now. So you don't actually go out and poke things with a stick anymore like when we were kids. When we were kids, you just poke things with a stick, and if it made sounds, you know, you wrote it down. Now it's all statistics and computers.
So it's lies, damned lies, and statistics.
Yeah.
A model made by a computer that's supposed to say that something happened. Okay, got it.
Yeah, that's really, you know, I don't know if you read much on how they sequenced the genomes, but the only way they could actually do that was, like, find these long strings of genes and then match up, like, how they overlay, which was another statistical thing. It was kind of cool.
Yeah,
I remember doing some consulting with some company in the middle of the country that sounded a lot like it had the word gene in their name. I forget who they were, but, yeah, we helped them build out those kinds of algorithms. I want to say that was, like, 20 years ago.
I think the guy's name was Gene, John.
So Mr. Green Jeans could be it.
James? Dean John?
Green Jeans. You remember Green Jeans?
Oh, who doesn't? Come on.
Captain Kangaroo.
Yeah, there's some.
The background of this article talks about anecdotal evidence. So it's more than, you know, it's anecdotal evidence, and maybe they're doing models, but...
Yeah, it's interesting. The older you get, the more you're kind of like, well, you know, okay, guys, it sounds kind of cool, but, you know, well, we've got time. We can wait and see if it comes out to be anything or not. So it is
interesting just to read something like, you know, such and such tumor CTVT has existed for thousands of years.
That freaked me out. I was on Hacker News reading, and somebody brought this up and said, hey, you're really like this. And I looked at it and I'm like, holy cow, that if true, that would change a lot of biology.
And I know there's a crazy DNA marker that pretty much, like, it's a sad story. We have folks we know, some friends who literally, the wife died, the one son had, you know, as a young man ended up having defects and, you know, had a leg amputated from cancer, I guess. He's now dead. I mean, it's like...
Thanks, John.
So good
to have you come by.
His head grew these big mushrooms. We're sorry about your friends.
The other son got tested. He does not have that marker. You know, some crazy ass marker that is almost like it's an even interesting question. Should you get tested? Because do I want to know? I'm going to likely meet the Grim Reaper before my time.
Yeah, they're doing that with Alzheimer's as well. Alzheimer's, they're working on some blood tests, like maybe 10, 15 years ahead of time. You can know you have it, but there's nothing they can do to treat it. So,
yeah.
So, it'd be a much better excuse than just, I forgot, sorry.
Well, hey, that's a good point. So I'm adopted, and a couple years back, I did a DNA test because it seemed like fun. I wasn't looking for anybody in my family, but I found out I had this huge biofamily. And my biological dad was known to tell a lot of, my granddad was known to tell a lot of jokes. I don't know if this runs in the family or whatever. But he ended up with dementia. And the thing is, they didn't figure it out for years because he kept telling jokes and nobody ever thought he was serious. Until it finally turned out, they're like, hey, no, actually, there is something wrong with this guy. That was kind of an interesting story. So I guess...
You already told us that one just a minute ago.
So I'm adopted. I did this DNA test a while back.
Nothing to make light of, but it's, yeah.
Well, yeah.
So jokes being kind of an art of BSing. So, Daniel, do you think you got those genes? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Statistically, I think that, if you ran the numbers, that perhaps I... So, yeah, this works either one of two ways. To James's point, either you can go, hey, I've got this thing, so I'm okay for forgetting stuff, or you can just tell jokes and ignore the whole thing until you forget who you are one day. So this next story is kind of odd. This is just a sentence or two. It said, friends of mine created a popular video game that was run on live TV around the world. It was called Hugo the TV Troll. And they made it for the Commodore Amiga. They didn't want networks to know this because it would not have been accepted as TV quality signal. So what they did was they got a big flight case on wheels, put the Amiga in there, put a lock and a breakout panel on the back, saying this was an extreme corporate secrecy measure. And then they went around for years and made a whole ton of money by carrying this Amiga around in this lockbox. And so my question is, you know, how much of programming, and I don't mean just consulting, but I mean just how much of programming itself is more of sort of a presentation performance type thing? What's been your experience? I know you're very shy.
Oh. It's all smoke and mirrors, man.
you took a mail order course, didn't you? You can tell us.
I didn't bother to do that, man. It's just ones and zeros. And once you grasp the idea that it's just one and just zero, everything else just kind of follows from that. And you can smoke and mirror your way into massive, I don't know what. Probably dementia.
Horseshit was what I was going to think about. Yeah, dementia might work, yeah.
You can get your non-technical friends to glaze over in about 5 seconds.
Oh, yeah. Boom. Just like that.
One of the first commercial projects I had, I took over from this MIT grad, brilliant person, and she said, look, Daniel, the thing we do here is we just tell the customer what they ask for until their eyes glaze over. And she said, at that point, we're good. I'm like, cool, I can do this. And, you know, she was right. The thing is that they didn't understand what the hell we were talking about anyway, so just, you know. Keep talking to the guy, and you're done. You're in.
That's such a common sales technique, too. You keep on beating at him until they just finally collapse out of his monitor. All right, I'll buy the goddamn thing.
This describes my dating life for many years.
Bore them into
sleep. Here, another round. If I told you about my pet squirrel.
Just nudge. Well, this reminds me of when I was in Columbus, Ohio, at Ohio State. We lived off campus, so this would have been, you know, 1980-ish. And there was a company called Cube, Q-U-B-E, that was trialing a way. You know, you got a little box in your house, you got some kind of a cable there, you're connected to the TV, and you could play like Jeopardy. And they knew who you were, so sometimes we'd be on the leaderboard because we would rush back, you know, to make sure we could, you know, finish dinner and get on this damn game and kick ass. And, you know, of course, that's before Google, so you couldn't look stuff up. You really had to, you know, really had to just know it. And plus it's speed. So that was pretty fascinating, given the era.
Yes. Well, I read this from an article talking about the Amiga being the first PC you could buy that could, like, deliver TV signals. And that was a big deal.
The Amiga was a really cool platform. I remember my brother had it, and it had superior gaming. And I believe my recollection was it was all co-processors, right? It had a graphics processor. So it wasn't a GPU doing everything. It was highly dedicated co-processors, and it was pretty slick.
I recall
there were three processors inside there. One of them was named Porsche. I don't remember the rest of them.
There's Sid. Oh, cool. Sid did the sound, I think. Maybe it was Commodore. Maybe that could have been the 64.
That's kind of a common embedded, dedicated processor, things like that.
We know back then to do sound, it wasn't unusual. I remember reading Byte magazine that would give you little pieces of code to make the PC speaker make different little sounds because you could click it at a certain rate. You're making music.
Yeah, we used to tie the high-order bit of one of the registers in the computer to a speaker.
Why? Yeah. But why?
They didn't play music that way.
Yeah, okay. Doesn't sound like very good music. I don't know.
No, you know, square wave, but you can make tones that way. It's just the 13th root of 2 or something.
Okay, you didn't program in 7 bits and then have the other bit just randomly kick out whatever the was going, because that would be ugly. What does it sound like?
I once got a read relay to play Mary Had a Little Lamb. That was fun.
Good times.
Well, yeah, Bob, I heard you got in big trouble for that, though, at our former employees. Played Merry Christmas or something like that at the demo.
I didn't get in trouble for that. But someone we both know whose initials are BC did get in some trouble because he's the one who actually pushed the button to demonstrate that to the CEO of a $1 billion company.
Yeah. Where somebody spent a bunch of their extra time chattering relays to get them to play Mary Had a Little Lamb or whatever it was. Merry Christmas or...
I wrote all that code in hexadecimal. That was fun.
So Bob's at a bar and they're like, hey, what are you doing, Bob? Well, I'm writing Mary Had a Little Lamb and I've got 42 pages of hex code.
It only took me like a day.
Woohoo, yes! 3 blind mics next week, guys. Putting a band together.
Frozen on everybody's screen?
Yeah. So if you stop and start video, sometimes it picks it back up.
Although you're looking pretty happy that way, John.
Yeah, you can just leave
it. All right, I'll do it again. Huh? This time I'll smile.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, maybe it's there we go. Hey, the smiling seemed to work.
Oh, froze again.
It's like, remember the old TV antennas you have to hold the right way? Like, you know, Dad be like, no, stay right there, kid. But you're like in the kitchen.
Why doesn't Google just OEM, you know, white label Zoom?
Oh, you're good now. You're good. You're good. You're actually moving. All right.
Oh, yeah, there we go.
So this next one's 2 links. The first link is this card game, and this is kind of a cool idea. So first let me show you this, something I did a couple years ago, just to sort of have fun and talk about SPAS. SPAS, single-page applications, became quite popular in the web coding world, and people made it into a sort of complete disaster because it was popular. So I made in a real SPA, which is just a chessboard. You can just click and move the pieces around, and there are no rules here. It doesn't check the rules. It's just you click whatever you want, And then it makes a link at the top, and you can email the link to another person. They end up at the same chessboard. So there's no persistence layer at all, aside from the URL. Bless you.
Oh, that's cool. And you just basically replace whoever you click on.
Yes.
How do you capture a piece here? I was playing with it earlier, Daniel, and I couldn't capture anything.
Oh, that's just, it would take the...
There's no rules.
Yeah, there's no rules. There's no... Oh, here we go. Click, click. There you go. Oh, it switches. Oh, delete. I'm sorry. Click, delete. Click, delete. There we go. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, just swaps them. If you just put the other one, just swaps them around.
Right. That's the castling, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's exactly why I did it that way. You just castle quickly. Yeah,
that's a good default.
I think it's for pacifist chess players.
I'm sorry, James.
It must be for pacifist chess players.
It is for, yeah. But of course,
it must be for pacifist.
Yeah, it was the it was the simplest thing I could do to actually show something that was halfway useful. You can actually add comments here, and you can say white to mate in three, and the whole thing's an URL you sent to somebody they can look at on across Twitter or whatever. It is a spa. It's a pure spa. And if you look at the code, let's see how. I'll show you this one. Yeah, if you take a look at the code here, you can see that off to the right here, there's just, I don't know, a couple hundred lines of code. And that's HTML, styles, everything. So it is truly a small spa.
What editor are you using there, Daniel?
This is VS Code.
Oh, VS Code, huh?
Oh, yeah. That's cool kid stuff. It doesn't come with the duck, by the way. You have to pay extra to get the duck in there.
Other people made real games, probably with actual rules.
Well, it's interesting because I did this a couple years ago, just sort of essay thing to write and talk about it. And I talked about how you could add the engine on top of that next, and how to keep that simple. And somebody, I think, either picked up on my idea or came to the same conclusion on their own. And he made this sort of generic, or she made this generic, play any number of like a dozen different kind of games.
Yeah, it's actually a great demonstration of, I didn't have to build it all. But look at this, it's a good way to show that I got a board, I got things I can put on it. Do I have rules? One. I just replaced whatever you drag in.
Yes. And he did the same thing. He said the game without rules. And so the only thing he really added here was the other games and the fact that he did the synchronization system. This is usually done like as a React demo or various. I've seen this like a half a dozen times where like, hey, I can change this on this web page and it appears over here. That's really the thing he added that was kind of the new thing. There's no URL sharing here.
I remember Meteor did that where, like Mongo backed. You could change something over here, and it would, you'd have it logged in on another terminal, and you'd see it.
And so I went to his source code. I was kind of interested in what he did, and it kind of starts off kind of simple. There's this sort of small bit of code that's mostly images. Then he loads in this web-bundle JavaScript. And I will load that rascal up, and it's like, ba-bam! It is a lot of stuff. And you end up with a lot of prototyping, a lot of stuff. He uses Firebase. So yeah, it was kind of a good example of how you can take the same idea, expand it, but then it was an example of, wow, do you really need all that stuff for what he's trying to do? I don't know, it doesn't seem like that to me, but I don't know.
Oh, just, import the massive framework and use 1/10 of it, who cares?
Well, that was my, I wanted to use his code as an example. It used to be if somebody did something on the web, you brought the code in and looked at it to figure out how it went, and now I looked at it, I'm like, holy shit, I don't want to go through all that. I mean, good God. I've got better than that.
You just download 78 little frameworks, right? Or big frameworks. Just use a bit of
them. Yeah, so there's might be a tipping point where you want to have that conversation. But boy, if you have that conversation early on and you can't get that, if you need something like that and I can snap in, I'll give you a personal example where I needed to get to millisecond timing on a PC. And this is back in might have been a 386. Might have been, even a 286 with a coprocessor. Might have been a while ago. So I've probably read something in C report or something that you probably wrote, Bob, or, a journal that you edited. Because I have some in my garage, and I probably have your name in there, in the barn.
I think Bob was against ones and zeros when they first came out. It's like, we don't need the damn numbers here.
Yeah. Just. So So I read this article on how to overclock the timer chip to get millisecond resolution, because by default it was only 53 milliseconds was the tick, even though you could fool yourself by seeing three decimal places that pretend that it's accurate, but it wasn't.
Yes.
So I did this assembly code. I remember along the way, I think I destroyed something because it destroyed some part of my memory on the system, but it's pretty funny. Anyway, I got to work. Actually was used in some PhD experimentation around kind of like head-up display symbology reaction time. So that the Dr. Commander Deaton wanted to test different reaction times, different symbols, I think. So it was highly reliable and good timing. And then not longer after the first use of it, I was reading one of those rags, and I saw, Ryle timing systems or something like that, millisecond resolution timer, and I bought it for the large sum of $50. And as fast as I could rip out my piece of shit assembly code and swap it with somebody who actually gave a crap about that functionality, like that was, that was core to his world, context to mine.
Yes.
And I was happy to take his library that improved over time and actually better to write your own.
That's an interesting judgment call, because at some point you don't care, but then it's like, well, wait a minute. Browser compatibility is another good example of, like, you might start off not caring at all about it, just trying to get something, make a MVP, and then work on browser compatibility down the road somewhere.
True. Cool. Yeah, and those are all judgment calls. When to care about, some framework that gives you that for free, but gives you like a shit ton more. Like when the, so it's a great, the point is, Bob raises a good point that should be thought of, not blindly ignored.
Right. The mistake is to either try to build everything out of ones and zeros, or to like feel like a kid on a shopping spree and just be pulling stuff left and right. Both of those are bad ways to go.
Yeah, and it also depends where in the maturity of the product you are.
Yeah. There's a discussion on value discovery and a discussion on value production. So, if you're just startup, discover academia, discovering value. You're looking to rapid prototype and do some rapid feedback. If you know where the money's coming from, if you know there's technical value there, well, then you're talking about value production, right? It's different conversation.
Yeah.
All right. So next up. Oh, yeah. So for the first time, drones autonomously attacked humans. And so in Libya, I guess they're having some problems with the various terrorist groups not getting along with one another. And so they launched a drone that actually hunted down some of these guys as they were trying to retreat and killed them on their own, on its own.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Facial recognition?
Not yet.
That is not my reaction.
Sweet. With a hammer, bam!
I'm a big drone proponent.
I can tell it.
like we needed to build a larger marching band stand for the marching band at the, I'm on a school board. And I joked, I said, well, not really, I was half serious. You can use a drone for that. Put it up, and then you can see even better than your freaking tower that costs $30,000. But I didn't win the approval of my idea. But it put me in the annals of every once in a while someone will joke about it. Oh, a drone would be good for that. Drones are good for COVID. Send them out and with UVC light.
Yeah. You can also hunt down the people who don't get vaccinated. That'll keep them in their houses.
Put a little dart.
Vaccination drones.
Vaccination drones.
They come by and smell you. Yeah. Okay, don't give the Chinese communists any ideas. They might do it.
Yeah. I
already working on that one.
I don't want any Chinese communist sniffing drones coming around giving me vaccinations.
No. They welded door shuts on apartment complexes. Yeah, I wouldn't put it past them. But yeah, this is pretty crazy.
Yeah, so go ahead.
I was just going to say, again, 20 years ago, I created a nice searching tool for selecting the unmanned air vehicle of choice based on your mission requirements. You know, loiter time, payload, you know, range.
Vaccine content.
Spatial recognition capability.
Ability to kill your enemies.
Yeah, drone technology, I don't think people are aware of how rapidly it's going from, like, the Parrot drone flying around to, like, 100, 200 drones all at once doing swarming stuff. It's going to be different than you might imagine.
Wow. That's a cool idea.
Yeah, they're talking up to a million. I'm not sure how they're going to handle the communication between all of them, but, yeah, they're talking drones in big numbers. That way, if you shoot a few of them, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, well, they need to work on the techniques that birds use for flocks, right? And fish.
Yeah, fish don't fly.
Well, you need to know where my neighbor is. Yeah.
And we've come full circle to tumors turning into new species.
I think the tumor is jumping to be a drone.
So I think a million drones in the sky is a tumor.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Yeah. It's odd. You know, when I was younger, older people would say, you know, I don't understand how we have these crazy rules. And it would be something like seat belts or something. And I would be like, who cares about seat belts? That's not important. And now we're going like, I don't want a million drones. And kids are probably going, oh, who cares about a million drones? It's natural. Speaking of large numbers, the U.S. military is starting to get really interested in Starship. And I had this vision in my mind of like 100 Starships. Like in a bunker somewhere, and if you want a tank battalion anywhere in the world in 90 minutes, just blow them all off, and you can deploy a large amount of tonnage anywhere.
If I were the military, I'd be pretty excited about Starship.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine a bunch of generals sitting around and going, my God, that thing actually works? How long has it been since we've actually seen something that actually works?
Yeah, just don't. Yeah.
I mean, it's just wonderful. It's just wonderful to watch SpaceX work and do the stuff they do.
Oh,
and they got that space Starship to land properly with that crazy horizontal descent through the sky, and then it turns around at the last minute, just like Buck Rogers lands.
Yeah,
come on, that's gorgeous.
That is
SpaceX. Boosters that fly back and land on the goddamn launch pad. What the hell's that about? Come on, man.
Yeah. That's what I thought it was going to be when I was 12.
Right.
Yeah.
So
Forbidden Planet.
Are they landing them right next to where they launch them from?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're not worried about
the Starship on the pad that it took off from.
Yeah, Musk said he wants a 1 hour turnaround time if he can get it. That's the goal he's put for his team to have.
Wow.
That's crazy. So this, by the way, this is an odd segue. Not really, but the millisecond, sorry, that's the ADD. Just blurted out. The millisecond resolution timer that I worked on, I kept using that, including to send transponder signals to control missiles, you know, Navy and Air Force missiles. But the actual paper that we published about the research turned out, I get this phone call at my desk. Hey, this is so-and-so from the Society of Experimental Test Pilots, and you have been awarded the Harry S. Salmon Award for technical writing. I'm like, yeah, right. The hell yeah, like click, you know, calls back, you know, I'm probably making that part up. He says, no, really. And it's a black tie affair at the Beverly Hills Hilton or whatever, that place where they do all those famous things. And I'm like, yeah, right. Uh-huh. Sure. What are you talking about? No, serious.
Oh, my God.
You are published in the Society of Experimental. I said, no, I'm not. Well, it turns out somebody, like we published it in IEEE or something like that. Somebody lifted it, put it into this cockpit, which is with a magazine, maybe quarterly or something like that. So it was voted the best technical article because I said, it had to do with head-up displays and symbology, and you know, so we literally, my buddy and I, got, you know, all duded up, black tie. We're in the freaking hit, like, you know, we're just a bunch of young stupid engineers, and we go to this place, and you know, it has the round tables and all the wonderful serving and the, you know, musicians and the stage. And thank goodness the, you know, the person who's directing it saying, all right, you're going to be on first because it's the lowest award. You don't have to say anything. Like, thank God. Just stand there, get your award, and we'll escort you back off. So meanwhile, the table, like the people at the table were you know, one guy, I swear, was like an owner of a rocket company and, you know, the engine manufacturer. Like all these crazy people that are probably doing this stuff now. Like, you know, I felt like, wow, yeah, we're really out of place. I mean, there was like, I remember the dude, remember when they, the space shuttle repaired a satellite?
Yes.
You know, up, right? So this is, evidently this was a big deal because there was only enough for two tries. But he was such a good pilot, he was able to squeak out enough energy for a third try and he got it. So he gets an award. You know, Admiral Bose was there, the head of the cruise missile program, something like that. He's getting some award. Wow. There's some Russian cosmonaut who was hilariously, you know, womanizer and drunk half the time. He was a hoot. So there's all kinds
of after
parties.
Did they give him an award for that? Because, hey.
I don't remember if he was getting there. I think he probably got an award. But, yeah, thank God we went first because we were like. But there's a funny random tie between that embedded assembly code and this rocket. So that was hilarious. Because I didn't believe it. Yeah, sure we are.
As a programmer, you have to, I guess when we started, you have to work with people at different levels of organization. And if you're not careful, you kind of get this sense of awe going on that prevents you from actually doing your job. And so you need to somehow develop this sort of thick skin where you kind of go, okay, fine, you're a general, okay. We're still have work to do, we still may disagree, you know, that's fine. I used to be a general myself when I was a child. But, you know, you kind of work through that because if you don't, you'll never ever really do the work they're asking you to do.
Yeah, mindset.
Yes. Very difficult.
Yes.
So, yeah, this is really really cool if they just leave it alone. If the military, like, just lets Elon build them 100 rockets and just don't touch this until we finish, I think it'd be fine.
Did anyone ever mention it looks kind of phallic?
I wasn't going to say that.
Okay, then we won't.
Yeah, there's a Steely Dan joke in there somewhere or another that I'm not going to mention either. So.
Okay.
Look it up, kids. So the next is Amazon has a policy that you have to fire so many people in your organization as a manager every year. So managers are actually hiring people they know they're going to fire. And it's like, wow.
There's a policy going backwards.
Isn't that Jack Welch's approach?
Who's?
Jack Welch from the famous GE.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. Well, I remember when the company Bob and I used to work for, when they did the layoff, they were saying, well, you know, we've accumulated some bad people, so it'll just, you know, go find them.
Kill the bad people! Torches and pitchforks.
Okay, now we're going back to what's going on.
Yeah, I think the idea that Welch had was, you know, get rid of the lower 10% yes. of your staff, so to speak.
Yeah, Microsoft adopted that role. They did that for a while. Someone that James and I both know was responsible for walking through the floor and pointing out the people.
Oh, my God.
Oh no way.
There were several of them. They called them the Grim Reapers.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow. Well, you know, the military does this as well. Military has a system called up and out. So either you get promoted and you become a higher rank or you get out. And the reason they institute is because they ended up with a lot of deadwood down at the bottom levels of the organization.
That makes sense, though, right? There is a little, you know, you don't want a bunch of generals. Number one, it's really expensive, and number two, there's nobody to fight. So, you know, that makes sense that if you don't promote, we don't need, you know, we don't need all the former presidents hanging around being president. You know, we don't need, right? I mean, you need to up and out. I think that makes sense.
I'm quite concerned about the military. I think their readiness has gone to crap. Yeah, James?
Yeah, just government should... take on this get rid of 10% every year policy.
Hallelujah, brother. Can I hear an amen?
No, guy.
Sorry if there's any government workers listening.
Yeah. My grandpa was a good. No. Now, I think that the thing that we run into, at least I run into as a libertarian, you guys probably don't, is that government, for whatever reason, people think it exists to do the right thing, whereas the corporate world exists to do the efficient thing. And
So
they sell ideas on this is the right thing to do. Whether or not you do it efficiently or not, it doesn't really matter. You just have to do the right thing.
Yeah, that's such a farce, because of course the humans that are attracted to government are angels, and only evil capitalists are in business, right? Yeah,
that's been my experience. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Thing about trading capitalism is that capitalism works even if the motives of the person you're dealing with are poor. So the guy can not like you, could be a surly person, maybe hard to get along with. But hey, if he's selling you hot dogs on the street, it's fine. It all works for the greater good. In government, you know, you have to either assume that people have poor motives, which is how we formed the country, or you have to sort of have this sort of imaginary idea that everybody's going to be like angels that are going to go do this, and that's never going to work.
Yeah, and you know, one of the reasons I created some of the initial lightweight methodologies was because I was doing Defense Department working. Plus, I had spent 4.5 years working as in the government testing cruise missile engines. So I saw people literally reading the newspaper, just doing everything. But I'm busting my freaking ass, and I made sure my boss knew. Get this person the hell out of my eyesight. I don't care if you can't do anything about him, but I don't want him in my cubicle because he's just a low sucking government money doing nothing.
And once again, you are kind of new to this nerd route of thing. He's a most disgusting, terrible. You know, I've worked with some good government people as well, right?
Oh, I see friends of mine all the time. Matter of fact, we just went to visit one that I've known since my very first job. So yeah, and one of them, Rich Thaler, is, I tell him all the time, you're one of my heroes, one of my mentors as a young engineer. You know, I had a great, you know, boss was great. Rich was great. I mean, these guys were the best thing for a young engineer who was eager to try to do as much as possible. Right. So they let me go. They let me do, you know, it was an amazing experience that I wouldn't anything.
So one of my first government jobs, I had a boss named Suki, who was Korean. And as I started as a senior level engineer. And I'm like, Suki, this equipment really sucks. She's like, here's my corporate credit card. Get whatever you need. So I went out and bought $7,000 worth of equipment. And she comes back, she said, $7,000? I'm like, well, we needed this. So she's like, all right, I'll make that fly somehow or another. She ran interference. It worked out okay. That's a good boss.
Back when $7,000 meant something.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
So we got a couple more left. This is Steve Jobs. This is basically 3 minutes of Steve going, this is when he was rolling out the Next. He was like, you know, all new technology has about a 10-year slope. It peaks at one point, and then about 10 years is sort of dropping off before the next piece of tech comes out. And that's really all he says here, but it's pretty insightful for 1988.
Glide slope.
Glide slope.
There's a piloting technique.
Yes.
Like the space shuttle has a glide slope. Don't screw it up.
They call that the brick glide scope.
It's pretty much one-to-one.
Yeah, it's funny they would call that a lifting body when it just basically just kind of falls out of the sky.
Well, it's a lifting body when you're like Mach 15.
That's a shame.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, one of the guys I worked with worked on the dinosaur or something like that. One of those old lifting body things.
Oh, wow. Oh, the sled, maybe? The first Blackbird?
No, it really was one of those.
Oh, the old X, the X-planes, right? X-21, X-35? Yeah.
No, I worked on the X-35, but at least the flight control system. We modeled that and did some post-stall maneuvers in the simulator. But no, the 1960-something dinosaur, S-O-A-R.
Ah, okay. So they didn't actually have a flying dinosaur in the 60s. That's,
It was a lot before then, Daniel. Much before then was when the flying dinosaurs were there.
Yeah, well, back when I was coming up, we had real flying dinosaurs. You didn't have to program them or nothing.
Triceratops.
We know.
So Bob, at Teradyne, where we used to work, when our entrepreneur left, Frank Bauer started... calculating the demise of the division, and basically the rise went up to a peak, and then it just had a steady decline until, you know, intercept zero, and then they closed the doors.
I understand we have the nickname of the Undertaker.
Frank did?
That's how I recall it. Someone we both know told me that once.
Oh.
Is this the same place that had the Grim Reaper? Or no, that was Microsoft.
No, that was Microsoft. And that was the same person who told me both things.
They're related.
So right. is it true that technologies have a 10-year lifespan? I understand when Steve Jobs said that, he was probably being optimistic, because I think probably technologies back then had a much shorter lifespan. But nowadays...
So here's what if I understood, and I'm trying to read between the lines, what he was basically saying is about every 10 years, something comes out that may be the same as before, but is different enough in a platform sense that people start developing on that platform. So, for instance, the web may stay the same, but now we're going to all do Webpack and React or whatever. And so once that shift happens, it's got about 10 years as it dies off, right?
Okay, I get that idea. He's just talking about the fad aspect of it.
When the commercial aspect of actually building and selling on top of things, things build up their own momentum such that companies want to stay in that space, and it just sort of dies off.
That didn't work so well for him as far as Next is concerned.
Nah, that's ironic.
No, that was a cool Next box.
Yeah, although it was the box that the web was spawned on. Tim Berners-Lee used the Next machine to do the very first web server.
The movie Jobs is really good if you guys haven't seen it. Excellent.
No, I have not.
Yeah, saw that one.
So this next one is about an anthropologist talking about what we lose from when we work from home. And this is all about how sort of informal conversations and going out to dinner and like we're doing here ends up, you end up transmitting a lot of important information that you really didn't know otherwise.
Amen.
And the cool thing about this topic, it appeared on Hacker News on Thursday, was as soon as it appeared, programmers were like, well, I don't see why we can't just work from home. And it's one of these things where it's like, guys, if we can do this, let's go work from home. But if we can't, we need to be honest about whether it works or not. It's just because you want to do something doesn't necessarily mean it's possible.
I'm sure that there is a competitive advantage to getting a group of people in the same room
and
working together. So once that becomes clear again, I imagine we'll see everybody gradually moving back towards in-person work.
John, I don't know if you've done this.
Nonsense.
What we used to do when I did this sort of a parachute in work was we'd show up, work with the customer, have a lot of informal conversations, sort of get everybody's head around where you wanted to go. And then there was just sort of a natural point where, like, okay, we've got a few weeks of grunt work. It doesn't matter whether we're here or not. And you could sort of, at that point, you could go home. Didn't really care. Nobody cared.
Yeah. I'm dying to get on a stage again. Gee, Chris.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And see three-dimensional audience. It's so hard, especially when. The last thing I did was a conference in India, and of course, no faces at all.
They didn't hold faces in India?
No.
Oh my God, that's an awful. Oh jeez.
They all were starting these just two-letter things on their head.
the zoom diagrams. Yeah.
Yeah, and you can't read that. Audience, it is really hard. I try to throw Slido in there and ask dopey little questions now and then, just to spice it up and see if they're still alive. But yeah,
talk in India, well, remotely, not in India, but remotely, and the people all had a little button they could push. So if they liked something you said, they'd push this button, and then there'd be a bunch of little thumbs up floating by through the screen. And I would say something and I would notice they liked it. It's like, oh, you guys actually can communicate with me. It's like, you like that. Okay, I'll tell you something else about that. And then they missed one of my jokes and they said, well, you know, that was supposed to be fun.
Let me repeat this again, maybe.
And then a bunch of thumbs went up, you know, when they realized that they'd missed one of my jokes.
Yeah, so I wonder what webinar format that was.
I don't know. It was Naresh. Was it Naresh? I could find out.
That would be, yeah, that would, because that, even that's a sign of life and a little bit of feedback that
Well, the early Nielsen studies would have these little knobs. They still do. They'll have like knobs you turn to determine how much you like somebody, what somebody's saying real time, up and down.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting, there's a whole ton of interesting stuff here. This is a serious long form article. The moderator Hacker News said, guys, just don't trash it. At least read it first. And a bunch of cool stuff. One of the things I liked was the fact that the programmers were modeling out how to debug the copying machines at Xerox. But really, that wasn't actually how they were being debugged in the field. In the field, they'd go out to dinner and figure things out. And there's this whole other sort of knowledge base and way things worked in the field that didn't match up with the tech manual at all.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember doing a really exotic, speaking of Tim Berners-Lee, I remember meeting him. But we did the semantic web work, all remote. Well, my buddy and I, we live 30 minutes apart, but everybody else, you know, was flung around the world from South Africa to UK to some island off of freaking South America, I forget where. Oh, in Italy. So in some sense, when you know, and this would have been circa 06, maybe 03, no, maybe 03 to 06. But it was, you know, knowing that you have to work that way, you can make it work. I think it would have been faster and better, you know, shorter feedback loops, more concurrent in the same time zone stuff, probably would have been better. But it was a small enough team that we could make it work.
Yeah, I think the key thing, I think it's the mental model of what you're trying to solve. When he talked about the programming, the fix-it book that wasn't matching up what they were doing, the problem was that the engineers back at the office had this their idea of how the office worked around their copier, which just didn't match up to how the real world worked. So the trick in having that sort of remote conversation is finding and challenging those models, right? I don't know how you do that. Maybe joking around like we do or whatever, but it's a hard, you know, a lot of people don't want to hear that their baby's ugly. And so if you've got some detailed mental model about the way things work that's whack, that's a very gentle conversation you might want to have over several weeks.
And that is a lot of models. From domain models to UML type models to even the model of the basic system as we design it with the semantic web in mind, how RDF works, yeah. Models are important in my world.
I completely agree. I think that many of us, and me included, are like little Ralphie on the Christmas story. And, it, you know, we're writing this essay for the teacher, and within two or three sentences, but just right as soon as you start making the model, suddenly you realize you're making the perfect model. The clouds open and the choir starts singing, and you kind of fall in love with your own work if you're not careful. And that's a difficult thing for us to deal with personally, I think. I mean, John, I'm sure you've seen somebody bring a UML model to a meeting that looked like a wiring diagram for like a nuclear missile or something. It's like, holy shit, what are we supposed to do with that?
Yeah. I'm glad I grew up poor and couldn't print anything more than an 8.5 by 11. So my modeling skills had to fit, you know.
Well, the good tools will let you layer things where you can like turn layers off and on to have certain conversations.
There's a group that was using the Rational tool suite to generate code, and they were making these models perfect and writing all their code in it and doing this week after week after week and getting in conference rooms and talking about how everything's going to work. And, you know, they never pushed the button and ran the code. probably one of the best things I could have done for them is say, well, push a button, make the code, and then write some tests for it to see if it works. And they started to do that. And then all of a sudden, then they said they were rejected from QA because they didn't find enough bugs in QA. So they had actually started trying out their work. And then it's like, well, you couldn't have possibly improved your process enough to actually not have bugs now. So we're rejecting you for not looking hard enough.
Oh, my God. Yeah, people used to ask me, is this model good or not, database, whatever kind of model? And I'm like, pizza crap. What are you trying to do with this? Like, you tell me what you're doing, I can tell you, you know, whether the model supports it. But without behaviors, this is just a bunch of structure you threw together somewhere.
Yeah, run it.
There you go.
And then I'm not trying to plug myself. Here's a picture of George Bush riding a shark, jumping out of an airplane, shooting pistols.
Now, why is that a plug for yourself, Daniel?
Because this is my slide. Actually, this is the lead picture for an essay I wrote this morning. So the reason I included this is because I spent a week writing this essay, and I finish hit the publish button. I go over and see the essay that about the Xerox and the anthropologist, and it's the same damn topic. And I don't understand how that worked, how the kismet works in like that, but it does. So it's just weird.
Are you selling a house? Is that what the MLS is all about?
Yeah, it's a tie-in between programming and real estate that people don't. They figured that out yet? It's code your way to a new home. No code down, real estate. So that's about it for me. Anything interesting happened to you guys? Have you read any books or watched anything cool on TV you'd like to talk about?
I just finished the fourth in the Bobaverse series.
Bobaverse?
The Bobaverse, yes. Yeah, this is a great
Are you writing series. These, Bob?
Yeah, myself.
Are you the author?
I wish I was the author. I wish it's a wonderful story. Dennis Taylor is the author. He's a computer programmer. He loads these stories up full of Easter eggs. If you're a programmer, they're absolutely hysterical to read. And it's all about this programmer in maybe 20 years in the future who freezes his head because he's going to die. And then he wakes up inside of a starship that's a von Neumann machine. And he goes and he flies around the solar system and then the galaxy, making more of himself, cloning himself, making more of himself. And so the first book, I think, is entitled We Are Legion. And it's this really very fascinating story about a guy named Bob who wakes up as the computer inside of a von Neumann starship. So anyway, there's four books in the series. They're all hysterical.
I also like to plug the audiobook versions. I made through three of the audiobooks, and they're hilarious. Very good.
Oh, the Bobaverse books?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
All right.
Cool.
Looks like I know what I'm going to buy for Georgia.
Yeah.
Get myself on the Bobaverse.
There you go. Might get you all the way to Indiana or Illinois, wherever the hell you're going.
Hey, so, Daniel, I don't know. Maybe next time I might want to show you guys this Gathertown.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Well, my son organized a conference for PhD chemists at University of Florida, and they used this thing. It looks like a 3D, it looks like a 2D game, kind of reminiscent of Pac-Man. You join a space, and you get a little icon, and you can walk around the space. And if I happen to see Bob Martin's little icon, I could walk over to it, and we'd instantaneously have a meeting, and where we'd have video and audio with each other.
Ooh.
And you can go into little rooms, and in the rooms, everybody in the room can talk to each other but not bother anybody else. And I can go up on the podium and talk to everybody, and everybody can see me. And if somebody wants to talk to me, they can walk over and talk to me. And then if I want to answer their question privately, we can go walk up to a room. It's like...
What's it called? Gather?
Gathertown. And so I've made the Wingman Software Training Center, which if you want, I'll give you guys a tour of it sometime when I get back to Illinois.
That'd be cool. Buddy,
please add it to the list. That. Yeah, add it to the list, James, so be sure to do that like the first thing, because that would be cool.
Okay.
Yeah, it's funny because my buddy and I were just talking about that. He's in London. We're saying, yeah, wouldn't it be cool if you could be a little more like in an office, that like that spontaneous being able to have a conversation, being able to go in a room and seeing the stuff that we would draw on the, like our models about things. And they'd still be there when you walk back in the room. There'd be something on the wall.
Did you guys see the link? I don't mean to interrupt, James, but there was while I'm remembering this, there was a link. Google has a new product that's supposed to be three-dimensional rendering of other people such that it looks like they're in the same room with you.
No.
That sounds awful.
Yeah, it does. It's bad enough looking at you guys on the screen, I guess. Jeez, enough.
Yeah, so have you used Tuple, the pair programming tool?
Nope.
No.
Oh, no.
That's actually very good.
Tuple?
Tuple. T-U-P-L-E. Yeah, very, very good. It's an audio connection, small video connection, good screen sharing, easy to go back and forth, take the screen or give the screen, more than two people. So it's very, very good tool. So far, I've had a lot of good luck with it.
Only on the Mac.
That's possible. That's all I ever think about.
VS Code, if you guys have it, and that runs on the Mac too, has a Code Together a plugin. It's supposed to do kind of the same thing, but I've never used it. I've installed it, but never used it.
Cool. I might get to try some of these out if I can convince one of the current clients to go BDD, and I can help them out.
You're still doing a lot of Gherkin?
Yep. Given when thens, yeah.
Cool stuff.
It's also a good way to write features. It helps make them more succinct and know what done looks like.
So I have to ask you, who's writing the Gherkin? Because that seems to be topic of discussion whenever you introduce Gherkin somewhere. Are you writing it?
Ideally, you meet with the business and the developer and the QA. You get a good feel for it. It becomes a little challenging to write it in that threesome because it's a little long to get it right. So I abandoned trying to do that on the fly with the business expert in the room. So I try to promote the QA and the devs immediately after we talk about the feature, learn about what it's supposed to do, ask those kind of questions about scenarios and things like that, then go off, sit down, and write the damn Gherkins together. And then typically the devs are mostly responsible for the acceptance test with QA kind of convincing and helping. But then that leaves QA to go off and do the other stuff to do, like, I don't know, exploratory testing versus doing the developer's crap. Goddamn acceptance test. Don't make someone else write them. Yeah.
You don't want to offshore your development test because that kind of defeats the whole purpose, doesn't it?
Yeah, then you get your test after. I use James's graphs all the time. I just lift them from his presentations and use them somewhere else. But yeah, it's the whole test after bullshit. Now two people get to learn how the story's supposed to work.
Yeah, I'd like to at some point talk to you about how you're structuring your feature files and all that, but this is probably not the place for that.
Sure, I'd love it.
So, go ahead.
We are Legion, we are Bob.
Yeah, there you go.
All right.
All right, guys, give me about 30 seconds to wrap this up here.
Okay, wrap it up.
Okay. Where are we at here? There we go. You have wasted yet another hour that you could have been studying to be a doctor or something useful in your life listening to Nerd Roundup. And there's my head is frozen. Why is my head frozen? Thanks for coming by. I appreciate your time and hope you've had fun. We'll see you next week. I'm Daniel Markham, and I will see you on the internet.